This is a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.
Karen Reed back in court again today, and we're going to take you right there for all of the coverage of what's going on in that courtroom and the follow-ups with Judge Beverly Cannone. Let's go there right now.
Draw near, give your attendance, you shall be heard. God save the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. This court is now open. You may be seated.
22-117, the Commonwealth versus Karen Reed. Can I have counsel identify themselves for the record, starting with the Commonwealth?
Good morning, Your Honor. Barbara Blossom for the Commonwealth.
Good morning, Mr. Blossom.
I'm Barbara for the Commonwealth. Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning, Mr. Lally.
Good morning, Your Honor. Hank Brennan for the Commonwealth.
Good morning, Mr. Brennan.
Good morning, Your Honor. Alan Jackson for Ms. Reed.
Good morning, Mr. Jackson.
Good morning, Your Honor. Elizabeth Little, also on behalf of Ms. Reed.
Good morning, Ms. Little.
Good morning, Your Honor. Robert Alessi on behalf of Ms. Reed.
Good morning, Mr. Alessi.
Good morning, Your Honor. David Unetti for Karen Reed.
Good morning, Ms. Unetti. Good morning, Ms. Reed. All right, so we have a lot to cover this morning, but what I want to start with, I was just handed a couple of things, too, that I'm going to need some time to read. What I'd like to start with, it's paper 613 filed yesterday. Defendants assented to motion to continue trial date to a date on or after April 25th. Who's going to argue that? Because just because it's an assented to motion does not mean it's not likely going to happen, so I need to hear argument on why I should do this.
I'll address the court with the court's permission.
Yes.
As I indicated to the court the day before yesterday, there is an issue, a very ripe issue, that is currently pending before the First Circuit. We believe very strongly that if the First Circuit were to take some action as to count one and count three, just to reiterate what I've already said, but I can sort of clarify it and narrow it down. If the court were to take some action on counts one and three, which is currently before the First Circuit, for instance, if it were to be remanded for either dismissal or something else, additional hearings, etc., then that puts the entire case in jeopardy. Once the jury ultimately is impaneled and thereafter sworn, jeopardy will attach. There will be, if in fact there is action taken on count one and count three, we will be in a position where we will seek a mistrial. Jeopardy will have attached. She will be held once in jeopardy on count one, two, and three, and we believe that puts the entire case in peril. The case that we're defending right now, very clearly, is a murder case, ultimately.
All three indictments, correct? You're defending all three.
But it starts with murder. That's the sun rises and falls on a murder charge. And there's also vehicular manslaughter, and then there's the leaving the scene, count three, and the subordinate counts beneath count two as well. That's a very different jury and a very different trial strategy than simply count two, if we were to be defending count two or it's the subordinate charges. So I think it puts the case in jeopardy if we do not have at least some time for the First Circuit to act and determine whether or not it wishes to act on counts one and three. Hence, that's why I suggested to the court the other day that it might be more prudent and less perilous for the case if we were to put this case over for at least a few weeks. We've spoken to the Commonwealth, and the Commonwealth tends to agree that that probably is the better practice, and we've asked for the court to extend the beginning of the trial to April 25th, which is about a three and a half week continuance, and I'll submit.
All right, does the Commonwealth want to be heard on this?
Your Honor, the Commonwealth is relying on advice of appellate counsel. I don't contest any of the defense's perspective for wanting continuance. I think the Commonwealth's perspective is different, but not adverse. The concern is that this case in the federal court gets delayed for an extraordinarily long period of time, and we have an interest in this case going to trial as soon as possible. There is an expedited scheduling order, which could hopefully imply that there's going to be quick progress in the federal court, but we don't directly communicate with them or have any control. Our hope is that if there is a short continuance, it accommodates the defense's concerns. I understand the trial strategy for different charges is somewhat different. But most importantly for the Commonwealth, the hope is that it sets a benchmark that will allow the First Circuit to resolve the petition, or if they're going to allow oral argument, a benchmark to do it quickly. And so really the primary motive for agreeing to the defense request is that we hope by offering a short continuance, the federal court will act more quickly and that we can have this trial in April.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to grant the motion. All right. We have jurors coming in that were summoned months ago. I called the jury commissioner yesterday and asked how long it would take to get the right numbers that we were able to get starting April 1st. At a minimum, 10 weeks. I'm not going to do that. What I will do is we'll start impaneling on April 1st. It will likely take a while. If we get a jury before April 25th, I'll rehear you on your motion. We won't swear the jury, because obviously that's when jeopardy attaches. And we'll take it from there, but we will start April 1st with impanelment.
Thank you, Honor.
Okay. All right, so let's go to the next motion, and then we'll go back to doing them somewhat in order. Commonwealth's motion for a buffer zone. Jimmy, do you have an extra copy of what you just handed me? Because I don't know where I put it.
Can get one.
I have it here somewhere. I'll find it.
I can get one.
So we did hear from people this morning. I know you all have. I have it. I have it, Jim.
Thank you.
I think Mr. McDermott gave you a copy of, I guess, what local merchants have requested.
We've received it.
Okay. All right. So I'll hear the Commonwealth on your buffer zone motion.
Your Honor, the Commonwealth's primary concern is the sanctity of the jury and the jury process. We are concerned, based on past reports and information, that noise, interruption, and other uncontrollable events can potentially impact the jury's consideration in this case. They should be free from outside influence, so it does not in any way oppress or push them in any direction, either way in this case. The courthouse is very close to the public areas where people congregate. It's been reported that during the trial, the jury would be able to hear outside noise and influences, not just honking of horns, but other types of noise that could be influential, intimidating, concerning. And so we've proposed what I think is reasonable and minimal recommendations to the court to move certain parts of the buffer zone, especially on the left side of the courthouse, where there seems to be a bit of attention, noise, and potential adverse influence of the jury.
And that's the same area that these merchants are talking about?
I've read that this morning, not being wholly familiar with the Dedham area. It seems that is one of their concerns. I think they mentioned an open market, in my memory from coming by on other cases and other times, there appears to be open markets in that area. And so if that's influencing their business, that is a separate but related concern that they have expressed to the court. And I do think that the court should be sensitive to the community's concerns. But importantly, that closeness and that amount of volume and influence on the jury, I think, can affect the sanctity of the jury. I don't think it is a strong imposition to consider the streets that have been identified in our buffer zone motion and have the buffer zone include limitations to those certain streets. And I think that will potentially help some of the outside impact and adverse influence on the jury.
All right. There's a portion of your motion that I disagree with. Do you want to be heard on it? About the court enforcing the buffer zone?
I don't believe the court has authority, nor should it be upon the court to enforce anything. I think law enforcement should enforce the laws and regulations as law enforcement sees fit. And so I don't think that burden should be imposed upon the court.
Thank you. All right, with that, does the defense object to the buffer zone?
We take our position.
Okay. All right, I'll take this under advisement. I have to figure out exactly how far this is, and I have not yet had a chance to read and consider today's email from the merchants. Okay. Yes.
Can I just have this marked for identification for this hearing, for identification? And from the record, that came from the Dedham Square Circle, the organization that runs the Dedham Farmers Market.
Thank you. So we can talk about the witness list when we talk about impanelment, when we really have the heart of the final trial conference. But I do need at least cities and towns from these witnesses. Neither side gave them to me on the civilian witnesses. So, and there's a lot of overlap, and you'll have to fix that for any final trial conference report anyway. So. All right.
Your Honor, can I be heard on that one issue, just briefly?
Which one issue? The witness list, okay?
Yes. We did turn over our witness list along with the information that's required under the new rules, which includes, you know, telephone numbers, addresses. We gave that directly to the Commonwealth. We did not file that publicly.
We'll happily
add the towns for the court. But I would note that the Commonwealth has not yet turned over that information that's required under the new rules. I believe they put a footnote on their witness list. I think, you know, they can't shield themselves from their discovery obligations. It's mandatory under the rules. We'd ask that they comply with, you know, the requirement that they provide us contact information for their witnesses.
So there is a footnote. I'll hear you, Mr. Brennan.
Your Honor, the motion notes that the Commonwealth moves to be partially exempt from Rule 14 because of the past history of perceived harassment and intimidation of witnesses, which the Commonwealth believes is ongoing. I think a potential resolution to this to comply with Rule 14 is that we be allowed to provide it to the attorneys under seal. I think that is protecting the interests of the Commonwealth and the witnesses from...
I don't have a problem with that. I still need cities and towns.
Of course.
Okay?
Yes.
All right. Thank you. So we will start with it's paper 593. The Commonwealth's response is paper 610. Defendant's motion in limine to allow evidence of lack of bias. Who's arguing that for the Commonwealth?
The Commonwealth first, Your Honor.
Well, it's defendant's motion. And the Commonwealth opposed it.
You had asked who's arguing that for the Commonwealth. That's why.
I'm sorry, defense motion. Okay. Sorry, I apologize.
I could go first if you'd like.
Excuse me?
I could go first if you'd like, whatever the...
I'm fine with him going first if you'd like.
Okay.
I think the heart of this motion is that the defense would like to introduce the ARCA witnesses as witnesses that were employed by the federal government. I think the reason for that is it creates the image or the projection that they are independent at the time they did their assessment and at the time they wrote the report, and then subsequently being employed by the defense has no impact on their objectivity at the time they did their investigation and report. I think this would be an unfair proposition for a number of reasons. It would undermine Rule 403. It would cause a trial within a trial. As we stand here today, the Commonwealth does not have a clear answer why this investigation was initiated, what the purpose of it truly was, the scope of it. We don't know every witness that may have gone before the grand jury. We do not know of all the communications between the federal government and different parties, including witnesses. We will, I expect, never have truly a full accounting of the relationship between the United States Attorney's Office and ARCA, and what, if any, impact the defense had on ARCA witnesses at the time they did the investigation. What we know is it was a comprehensive investigation. We know that a number of experts were retained by the federal government, including the ARCA witnesses. What we also know is that there was an inquiry lodged by the defendant to the federal government to investigate her situation, her case. What we know is that the defense had the opportunity to provide information to the federal government advocating for their perspective on the case, including the specific perspective of Ms. Reed. We also know the Commonwealth was unaware of this initiation and engagement and had no input whatsoever. What we know is that the ARCA witnesses were supposedly tasked to conduct an independent investigation, and they were given materials. We do not know who decided what materials to give them. We do not know what materials in totality they viewed. We know many of the materials that they weren't given. And so clearly there is a undefined relationship between the defense and the United States Attorney's Office around this time of this investigation. And we subsequently learned that there is was a continued relationship. And so today, as we sit here, we really don't know. What we know is ARCA listed materials that they reviewed that came from our discovery that we didn't provide. What we know is there was materials that they didn't review that were inculpatory. And so that's why we began by asking for discovery. We filed an extensive motion for discovery that the court allowed. It still hasn't been complied with. Perhaps some of it through no fault of the defense, because I don't think they will be able to comply with much of it. Other Rule 14 discovery obligations have not been complied with. We've received no information since that production on February 13th, nothing. And we know just inherently from that information that there is more. There are more communications, there's more interaction. And so it would be misleading to have ARCA witnesses get on the stand and then suggest that they were independently hired by the federal government and all of their attempts and efforts and report was wholly and entirely objective. Just to give one point that emphasizes the concern, the ARCA witnesses were never given information about DNA. And yet when they testified, one of the witnesses tried to address the issue of DNA because it was hurtful to their position. In their report, they say one of the reasons why they believe that there was no impact between the car and Mr. O'Keefe is because there was no DNA. Well, in fact, there was. There was DNA, and separately, there was a hair, Mr. O'Keefe's hair. And so we know they didn't have all of the inculpatory information, and then the question still remains, how did they learn of that? How did they learn of that information before cross-examination? And so I think what is most appropriate, before Your Honor makes a decision on the so-called objectivity of these witnesses, is they should come into court before trial, well before trial, and they should answer questions about their directives from the United States Attorney's Office. They should answer questions about the materials they received. They should answer questions about what they were told or what they knew about the case. They should answer questions about all of their correspondence with the defense, including phone calls, emails, text messages. All that should be produced. It's not a Lanigan hearing where I question their qualifications, but if we're truly going to think about presenting them as objective witnesses, they truly should be objective. And I think if we have an opportunity to question these witnesses, we will learn much more about the relationship. Inevitably, even if the ARCA witnesses come in to be questioned, as they should well before trial, in my opinion, we do not have the opportunity to question the United States Attorney's Office. We're resigned to TUI letters, which inevitably have been unhelpful. And so I think it sets a bad playing ground to have them get up and say they were hired by the federal government, because then the Commonwealth will be inclined to explain the inculpatory evidence, the role of the federal government, the limitations of the federal government, the fact that the federal government has closed this entire case in all related investigations, which implies something quite the opposite of what the defense would like to propose. And so in a vacuum, it would be misleading. I think what the court ultimately should do is they should present these witnesses as they did at the first trial. They were hired independently, and then subsequent to that, the defense retained them if that's what they chose to do. We still don't know that because we don't have any Rule 14 discovery. And inevitably, at trial, part of the credibility issue will be the information that they considered and the limitations on it, and ask them why they didn't ask for more information or why they didn't receive more information. Notably, we still don't have an answer to Mr. Klein, who was the third biomechanic person involved. And
is his name on the witness list?
I haven't seen it on the witness list.
No, Your Honor.
And we still don't know why the defense chose to call two of three. As you noted, that report is vague. And so it doesn't identify or articulate which witness did what. So it's impossible for me to imagine how you would choose two of three of those witnesses. But more importantly, you can't effectively cross-examine a witness because, as we saw from the second witness, Dr. Rentschler, when he disputed DNA, which we don't know where the source of that came from, he is not held to the opinion in the report saying that we would have found DNA. He can simply defer and say that was somebody else. That could have been Mr. Klein, could have been Mr. Wolf. We don't know. So that report really is quite unhelpful. And I think we need answers to these questions before any of these witnesses testify. And I do not want to be moving during trial to exclude the defense witnesses for failure to comply, but we haven't seen compliance, and I don't think we will. So my suggestion is to follow the protocol of the last trial, but before that, these witnesses should be brought in so that we can obtain actual records, not just ask them the questions and rely on their word. I think based on their past performances, that's insufficient. I think we should have a right to the records to demonstrate the relationship.
Mr. Unetti?
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, the Commonwealth and the defense certainly have opposite arguments when it comes to what the jury should be allowed to hear about how the ARCA witnesses became involved in this case. Mr. Brennan speaks about the heart of our motion. The heart of our motion is that the Commonwealth wants to hide the truth from the jury. The defense wants the jury to know the truth. In the first trial, this court disallowed the ARCA witnesses from testifying about who hired them. We were therefore forced to ask oblique questions, trying to show the jury that we didn't hire them, that we didn't provide them with information, that we didn't influence their opinions and conclusions. But we weren't allowed to tell the jury that the Department of Justice, the U.S. Attorney's Office, hired them. So the jury was left to speculate about how they became involved. I think the court will agree that it's ironic in a way that the court excluded mention of the Department of Justice and the U.S. Attorney's Office because the court rightly did not want the jury to speculate about a federal investigation. But by excluding mention of the federal government having retained ARCA, the jury was left to speculate incorrectly about how they became involved.
They were also instructed more than once not to speculate,
and,
right?
But the point of the fact of the matter is, Your Honor, they did speculate. At least one juror thought that ARCA was hired by Ms. Reed's car insurance or home insurance company. And think about the implications of that. If Ms. Reed's insurance company had hired ARCA, they would have had a motive to absolve Ms. Reed of responsibility. That clearly would have adversely affected their credibility in the eyes of the jury, and unfairly so.
Let me ask you a question. If I allow, and I'd be very surprised if I did, mention that this was a federal grand jury and that the federal, how does that not open the door to all the testimony that Mr. Brennan just brought up that he'd be able to get into?
Okay, so first of all, and this is later in my argument, we're not asking.
So, no, could you answer that now, and then I'll let you say
it. I'm trying to, Your Honor.
Oh, you just said it's late. Hold on. You just said it's later in the argument.
I know, but you interrupted me, and I was just about to say, but I'll address it now.
Okay.
We are not asking that the jury be told that there is or ever was a federal investigation. That phrase, federal investigation, never has to be part of this trial. We're only asking that they be told that the Department of Justice or the U.S. Attorney's Office hired these witnesses. That's it. We don't have to speculate about an investigation, whether there was an investigation, whether there was a federal grand jury, what that grand jury did, what that grand jury considered, nothing. That's not what we're asking. And the problem here is that without knowing that the Department of Justice or the U.S. Attorney's Office retained ARCA, the jury's left to speculate about how they became involved, and it all inures to my client's, to prejudice my client. Thinking that they were potentially hired by an insurance company of Ms. Reed really perverts the truth in this case. It's unfair to my client, and it's the opposite of the truth. There was another juror that speculated that the ARCA witnesses were just attention seekers, looking to make a name for themselves in a high-profile case. That's also the furthest thing from the truth. They had never heard of this case before the Department of Justice called them. That's how the Department of Justice wanted it. They wanted clean experts who would take a sober and strictly scientific look at the evidence. The federal prosecutors did not want them to be tainted by news reports or opinion pieces. And recall that the Commonwealth attacked ARCA on cross-examination for the discovery that they were not provided. That was patently unfair. ARCA should have been allowed to explain why they were given what they were given and who gave it to them. The inference is, and the Commonwealth suggested, that it was the defense that was playing hide the ball, when that inference is, again, the furthest thing from the truth. In terms of the information that the federal government got, Mr. Brennan engages in a ton of speculation about what happened or didn't happen based on nothing. There's no affidavit to establish any of that. I will tell the court that I received a subpoena for my entire file from the federal government, and I complied with that subpoena. We had nothing to hide. We provided everything that the Commonwealth provided to us, to the federal government. They chose what to give ARCA or what not to give ARCA, and they did that again to preserve the scientific integrity of their opinion. So, again, we're just asking that ARCA should be allowed to testify that they were hired by the federal government to prevent speculation about who hired them or why they became involved in the case. If the issue is we don't want the jury to speculate, the way to do that is to tell them the truth. We did not hire them. We did not influence their opinions. We didn't even know that they existed until that TUI request was complied with, and all of a sudden it was revealed to us that the federal government had hired these ARCA witnesses. And we read that information at the very same time that the Commonwealth read that information. Those witnesses, importantly, were available to be called by both sides. The Commonwealth chose not to speak to them. The Commonwealth chose not to contact them because the information was exculpatory. The jury should not be left with the impression that Karen Reed or the defense team had anything to do with hiring them or with their conclusions and opinions. The conclusions and opinions were revealed to us at the same time, and the court should guard against rank speculation. Mr. Brennan's other arguments about what they were provided or what the relationship was or what the understanding was, that's all cross-examination material. He's free to explore whatever he wants on cross-examination. So with that, Your Honor, we would ask the court to issue a ruling that does not mislead the jury about how ARCA came into the case.
Okay. Any follow-up?
Yes.
Respectfully, the Commonwealth does not look to hide the truth. The reality is, if the jury is going to hear information, they should hear the entire truth, not a version or a slice of it. not one advocate side of the truth, the whole truth. And if we interject that these witnesses were hired by the federal government and the jury's entitled to hear the whole truth, then they should know the motivations behind the hiring, the input from the defense team prior to their decisions, and what, if anything, they considered, and what their directive was. We don't have any materials from the federal government regarding direction, scope, purpose. We have nothing. Now, I didn't know that Attorney Iannetti's file was subpoenaed. That's new to me. Perhaps the Commonwealth knew. I've never heard that before. I don't know how the defense knows what the federal prosecutors wanted. They've never discussed that with us. We don't have that type of relationship with the federal prosecution in this case or their investigation. We didn't have any interaction, not because we chose to hide from exculpatory evidence or we were hiding from the truth. We weren't invited. We didn't know. Now, I hear now that Mr. Iannetti's file was subpoenaed and information, whatever it was, his entire file was given to the federal government and they chose whatever they chose. This report by ARCA was produced by letter February 12, 2024. We know from at least some of the materials we got, there's a document from Attorney Iannetti on March 29, 2023, describing his client's best memories of events, a number of pages talking about the case. So there clearly is a relationship that we are not privy to. I'm not casting aspersions or trying to suggest there was anything improper about the relationship. I'm not suggesting that. But there was obviously a relationship between the parties that the Commonwealth was not involved in. And so we can't take a fraction of something and say we present them as independent witnesses when there was a purpose, there was an agenda, and it wasn't in the Commonwealth's interest, obviously. The ability to cross-examine a witness is only as good as the evidence and information you have. As you've seen from the ARCA witnesses, from my opinion, my perspective, respectfully, is when they answered questions, perhaps it was not perjury, but it was quite misleading, suggesting no relationship with the defense, talking about DNA with no DNA evidence. I do not think that cross-examining a witness, you should consider the witness a trustworthy guide unless they've established their credibility. I don't see that in these transcripts. So I will need materials to hold them in check and to hold them accountable for whatever it is their bias. And so simply cross-examining aimlessly is totally ineffective. It's a recipe for disaster, and that's not the type of examination we're going to engage in. If we're going to tell the whole truth, it has to be the whole truth. And I think that becomes a dangerous game. There'll be an entire days, entire trial trying to advocate influence or no undue influence with these witnesses. It's unnecessary. It can be resolved through questioning these witnesses prior to trial and following the same protocol you did last time.
All right. So if the defense intends to call the ARCA witnesses, we need to have a voir dire next week. All right. So we're going to move on. I'll take this under advisement.
Can I just ask the parameters of that voir dire, the purpose of that voir dire?
Unless Rule 14 is complied with, it will be for the Rule 14 information. We can discuss this later. Let's move on, and I'll hear any objections later. All right, so the next motion is the defendant's motion for stating grounds for objections. I'll hear you on that, Mr. Iannetti.
Yes, I believe my written submission essentially makes the argument, Judge. But,
okay.
You know, during the last trial, as a result of our inability to state in, you know, one or two words the basis for an objection, we had to go to sidebar far more often than we'd like to. And we're also conscious of the fact that, you know, we have a jury sitting for weeks at a time away from their families, away from their jobs, and any, you know, sort of view that one side may be delaying the trial could engender some hostility from the jury. So, you know,
There were many times during the trial, I won't speak for my co-counsel, I'll speak for myself, where an objection was made. I had no idea what the basis of the objection was. And the court made a ruling on that objection, and I had no idea what the court's basis for the ruling was. We would go to sidebar, and the first thing the court would ask the Commonwealth is, what's the basis for your objection?
To make a record at that point.
Oh, I understand, but it's, you know, what's the basis for your objection? If it were that obvious that it could be ruled in open court, you know, we should have known the basis for the objection. I didn't know
it. I agree with that. And we should have known the basis for the objection.
Well, I'm hearing it for the first time at sidebar. There were objections made that I thought had no basis in the law or evidentiary rules whatsoever. But in any case, this will avoid us having to go to sidebar multiple times. There were times when we had to sort of pick and choose when we went to sidebar because, again, we didn't want to engender hostility from the jury. My motion also points out, Your Honor, there's at least one case that talks about how an objection could be potentially waived if it is not stated with particularity. We think that this would, and look, you know, different judges have different opinions regarding this. I've been in front of plenty of judges over my career who endorse speaking objections as long as there's no, you know, trying to coach a witness or, you know, trying to influence a witness in any way. And that's not what we're seeking to do here. The objection hearsay, the objection lack of foundation, just standard basic objections. There's no prejudice to stating them in open court. It will move the trial along more quickly. It will allow my client to preserve her due process rights. And we'd ask the court to change its ruling from the first trial.
Okay. That motion is denied. So the next motion, defendant's motion eliminate to exclude false and irrelevant statements of Michael Proctor, 591. Does the Commonwealth intend to put this evidence into the case?
We do not.
Okay.
So we can agree to that motion.
All right. So that motion's allowed, Ms. Tiannetti. There's a defendant's motion for reconsideration of the March 6th court order denying defendant's motion to exclude witness Crosby. Mr. Lessy, what I'm going to do with that is if I can readdress that before rebuttal, before the witness is called. So we don't need to do this now. We'll wait and see what Dr. Russell's testimony is and if the Commonwealth is going to call the witness. All right, so we can address it later.
Thank you, Your Honor. And okay. Also, just so I'm clear on that, and to the extent we argue for the need for a voir dire, would that also be part of Your Honor's consideration?
So if I feel I need to reconsider it, that's the time to do it, after Thank Dr. You. Russell's testimony. All right, there's a motion. It's 599. Defendant's motion in limine to prohibit the Norfolk District Attorney and Massachusetts State Police from having juror contact. So we don't need to belabor this. We talked about this before. No one has contact with the jurors other than the court officers. So defendant's motion in limine to prohibit Norfolk DA and Massachusetts State Police from having juror contact. I'll also include prohibiting defense counsel and the media as well. No one is to have contact with the jurors. The court officers are the only ones that have ever had contact with the jurors. So there's that. So I think now we move on to something that may take a little bit more time. The defendant's motion in limine to exclude the testimony of Dr. Judson Welcher. How do you pronounce his name, Mr. Brennan?
Welcher.
Welcher. And the Commonwealth's opposition. So who's arguing for the defendant, and how long do you think this might take? Because we can do some of the quicker Commonwealth motions if you want.
I am going to make the argument, Your Honor, and I estimate 40 to 45 minutes for this motion.
Okay. Mr. Brennan, how long do you think you'll take?
It's really dependent on what Mr. Lisi says, but I can't imagine it's more than 15 minutes, perhaps 10.
Okay. All right. Before we go there, there are a couple of the Commonwealth's motions that seem pretty quick. that I just wanted to know if the defense had objections to. Yeah. To appoint a stenographer, we've already done that. Prevent identification of jurors and impound the juror names during trial. Why don't we do a few of these, then we'll take the recess around 11, and then we'll come back with the lengthier motion. So I'll hear you on this, Mr. Brennan.
Thank you. Which motion, Your Honor?
It's your number one, 575. Commonwealth's motion in limine to appoint court stenographer, prevent identification of jurors, and impound juror names during trial.
Commonwealth believes appointing a stenographer is a prudent practice.
We've already done that.
Okay. Preventing identification of jurors, this case is a case that has garnered extraordinary public interest. There are some concerns that in the history of this case, jurors have been identified by different characteristics, whether it's their hair color, their profession, and inevitably, as the trial progresses, it seems through sometimes the media, the jurors, although maybe not identified by name, have some of those characteristics promoted. That would cause, I would think, a strong concern by a juror that their verdict could be disfavored by one side or the other. That's the last thing I think anybody in the courtroom would want. And so the jurors, I suggest, should not be identified before, during a panel, and during the trial. I think the jurors' names should be impounded. There has been past efforts by many to identify jurors, interview jurors, get information about jurors that is then highly publicized. That will chill, I think, the process of deliberation in a fair trial for both sides. I think it is a measure that is accepted, it's appropriate, and under the circumstances of this case, I ask the court to do that.
All right. Any objection from the defense?
Your Honor, we have no objection to appointing a court stenographer, impounding jurors' names and information, and in fact, we join in that request.
Okay.
The motion, however, also asks for the impoundment of all sidebar discussions. Before I address that, I guess I would first ask whether Mr. Brennan is pursuing that part of the motion.
I think that's a good question. Sidebar discussions regarding jurors?
If it's sidebar discussions regarding jurors, we're in complete agreement.
So sidebars are impounded regarding jurors anyway.
Oh, right. So we're in agreement with that. I interpreted the motion, perhaps incorrectly, that Mr. Brennan was seeking the impoundment of all sidebar discussions regarding all issues.
It sounds like he is because of the fact of people listening to FTR. All right, so I'll hear you on that.
Thank you. So we do question the impoundment of all sidebar discussions.
Okay, you agreed to it last time, right? So this is a change.
This is a new trial, Judge.
Right, just to be clear, this is a change.
I don't recall what we did or didn't do last time, but this is our position for this trial. Obviously, the reason some discussions are held at sidebar is to prevent jurors from hearing legal arguments on the admissibility of evidence. But this is otherwise a public courtroom. The public typically has a First Amendment right to know in Massachusetts what is going on in a public courtroom. And in fact, in Massachusetts, it's not just a First Amendment right. There's also a common law right to know what's going on in the courtrooms. And when justice is open to the public, it serves as a check and balance to the conduct of the parties and of the court. Consonant with these policies, in one of your recent rulings, Your Honor, the court recently cited to the strong presumption of Massachusetts law that a courtroom be open to the public. Therefore, there's both a state policy and a benefit to public disclosure of courtroom discussions and rulings. Of course, if there's something that is discussed at sidebar that involves information subject to a protective order, portions of sidebars can be impounded. If there's some other reason for a sidebar conference to be impounded, the courts can so rule at the time. But a prophylactic blanket impoundment covering all arguments made at sidebar would sweep too broadly over these important rights and policies. There's a lot of publicly available information about this case already in the public domain. There are commentators who write and speak about this case every day on the internet. Sidebar discussions become yet another source of information, but the court's able to guard against the jury being influenced by extraneous information outside the courtroom by instructing them every day, as you did during the first trial, that they're not to read or watch or pay attention to anything about this case outside the courtroom. And in that sense, sidebar discussions are no different than the daily news about this case that is discussed incessantly. And for that reason, we believe they should be generally made public.
All right. So last time they were sealed, and that was by agreement of all the parties. So this time there's an objection. What is the authority for me sealing or impounding sidebars?
I don't have an answer to that. It's something I'll need to look into because it is a legitimate concern of the Commonwealth, but there needs to be authority, and I can't say right now I have authority for it. I can tell you the concern is that many of the sidebars help vet out information that should not be heard by the jury. It's not the community that's the concern. Even the most diligent of juror in a trial of this magnitude and this length may hear extraneous information, whether they're looking at news reports or not, whether they're simply getting lunch. If there's evidence that is deemed inadmissible and prejudicial to the jury, there runs a real risk if the public hears the promotion of sidebar conferences. It's not an attempt to stifle First Amendment. It's not an attempt to deprive the community of the full value of the public trial. Rather, it is the concern that this case, unlike most or any, seems to have a political event component to it, and factions and sides and heavy promotion. The cottage industry in ways, unfortunately. And that creates an enormous amount of social media and media attention, which I embrace for the First Amendment, but we want to keep the jurors from hearing information that would be prejudicial or extraneous. And given the length of the trial and the heavy scrutiny in social media, that's the government's concern. But I agree the government should have a legal basis. If you'd give me an opportunity, we can offer the court whether we have that basis or not, but I can't tell you that now.
All right, so I am taking a lot of these motions under advisement. I'll give you until tomorrow afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Is there an objection to, it's 577, it's the Commonwealth's Exhibit 3, Motion 3, Commonwealth's motion for in-court identification. Is there any objection to that?
No objection.
All right, so that's allowed, Mr. Clerk. And the next one, Commonwealth's motion in limine to admit the one photograph of the victim, two photographs of the victim's injuries as observed by medical providers during the autopsy. Is there an objection to that,
objection.
Ms. Little? That's allowed. 578. So the manner of death, so that is on the death certificate. So this is your number five, Mr. Brennan. Paper 579, Commonwealth's motion in limine to preclude reference to and redact the manner of death contained on the victim's death certificate. I'll hear you on that. Yes.
Pursuant to Mass case law, Carmel v. Almonte and Wallace, as we've laid out in our memorandum, we would like to have the cause of death redacted from the certificate. Certainly, the defense can cross-examine any witnesses that are called regarding the manner of death, but this notation on the death certificate is extraneous and it should be inadmissible. General Laws, Chapter 46, Section 19, provides nothing contained in the record of a death which is reference to the question of liability for causing the death shall be admissible in evidence. Again, different when questioning a witness that is offering an opinion regarding the cause of death, but the certificate itself should be redacted and it should follow Massachusetts general laws and it should follow Massachusetts case law. For those reasons, we ask the court to redact any cause of death in the death certificate itself.
All right, who's arguing this for the defense? Ms. Little?
Thank you, Your Honor.
In this case, the medical examiner who completed the death certificate concluded that the manner of death was undetermined. The Commonwealth is seeking to exclude this information from the death certificate because it is exculpatory. The Commonwealth seeks not only to have the court redact the manner of death here, but they're also not calling the medical examiner in this case, which creates certain issues. All of the cases cited by the Commonwealth in this matter deal with the issue of whether it was error for the Commonwealth to admit a death certificate listing the manner of death without redacting the word homicide because it violates a defendant's constitutional right under the 5th and 14th Amendments to the United States Constitution. That is not the situation that we're presented with here. None of the cases cited by the Commonwealth that were just referenced by Attorney Brennan stand for the proposition that a death certificate listing the cause of death as undetermined should be redacted. If the court looks closely at even the cases cited by the Commonwealth, specifically Commonwealth versus Ellis, I'd urge the court to carefully read that opinion because what it says is that the SJC identified the words that best practice dictates should be redacted from a death certificate. And what the SJC said is this, and this is dicta, it's not even true case law. The better and safer course is to exclude from a death certificate the words homicide, suicide, or accident in a criminal trial. Notably missing from that is the word undetermined. And that's because undetermined is not a finding of liability. That is what the whole statute was meant to protect from. So there is no case law that suggests that the word undetermined should be redacted from a death certificate. The Commonwealth bears the burden of proof in this case. They have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that a homicide occurred. And the Commonwealth's own medical examiner has opined that she was unable to make that determination in this case. That finding is relevant, it's exculpatory, and it should not be redacted from the death certificate.
So you say the medical examiner is not testifying?
It's not, I believe the medical examiner is not on their witness list.
Oh, I thought I saw Dr. Scordibello. Oh.
Not on their witness list.
All right.
Number 81 on the Commonwealth's witness list.
All right. I'll take this under advisement. I'll take a quick look at Ellis again.
I would just note, I apologize. I know Attorney Brennan did represent at one point that they are not likely to call the medical examiner. So that was my impression.
Okay.
Perhaps I'm incorrect.
That's fine. Thank you. All right. One last, hopefully quick one. Commonwealth's motion in limine to introduce certified records from the Registry of Motor Vehicles. Is there an objection to that, Ms. Little?
No objection.
Okay. Probably one more quick motion. So that's paper 580, Jim?
Thank
you. Commonwealth's motion in limine with the intent to obtain Corey records of potential jurors. That's allowed as long as it doesn't disrupt the trial in any way.
May we be heard on that? Anyway?
Sure.
Your Honor, potential jurors are asked when they fill out the jury questionnaire whether they have a criminal record. They're also asked if they know anybody in law enforcement. They're asked if they've ever been a victim of a crime. And for every other answer on the questionnaire, the parties must accept the potential juror's answer, which that juror is giving under oath on the form itself. In fact, there are times when a court may deny an attorney from inquiring further about a clear answer on the jury questionnaire precisely because the answer was clear and it was given under oath. It is solely through the issue of a past criminal record that the Commonwealth seeks to question whether potential jurors are telling the truth. If someone claims not to know law enforcement, the Commonwealth is content with that answer. Does not ask for permission to conduct any further research. If someone claims never to be a victim of a crime, again, the Commonwealth is content with that answer and is not curious about whether the potential juror is telling the truth. In other words,
it is the potentially hidden, if the potentially hidden information benefits the Commonwealth in their viewpoint, that is, they're fine with that. The only way to make this process fair to both sides, therefore, with regard to this motion, would be to release to the parties, the jurors' questionnaires in advance of trial, so that each side can do their own independent research and investigation to vet the potential jurors in the pool. I know that there is case law to support the invasion into a juror's privacy regarding a check on the existence or not of their criminal records and a vetting of a potential juror's truthfulness. But it is interesting that the very first case the Commonwealth cites, the Hampton case, stands for the proposition that criminal records of prospective jurors are not an indispensable or necessary means to the selection of an impartial jury as a matter of federal or Massachusetts constitutional law. That was a case in which the defense had sought a Corey check of potential jurors, and the judge denied that request. And the SJC said it was fine to deny the defense's request. That means, Your Honor, that you would be justified in exercising your discretion to deny the Commonwealth's request to be allowed to invade the privacy of potential jurors, because pursuant to Hampton, it's simply not an indispensable or necessary way to select an impartial jury. Having said that, Your Honor, if the court is inclined nonetheless to allow the motion, we ask for an order that every bit of information turned up by the Commonwealth in their investigation of jurors be turned over to the defense.
I think that's the common practice of this office. What do you say to that, Mr. Brennan?
Is it the common practice of this office?
Your Honor, is the court's question common practice of giving everything, or is it common practice of running queries?
It's actually seems to be both.
I believe I've been informed that it is the common practice, and that is the practice we would follow to give everything to the defense. I think the assumption that the Commonwealth would not want somebody with a criminal record on the jury might be misplaced. Somebody who has a criminal record shouldn't be precluded from jury service. In fact, maybe people who have a criminal record in re-entered society who the Commonwealth would embrace as jurors. But sometimes people forget or mistake that they have a criminal past. It, I understand, may have happened in this case, has happened in many of my cases. And the nature of any past criminal record is sometimes helpful to see if there's an association between that and the charges in this case. So we would embrace providing everything to the defense and ask the court to allow our motion.
All right. If you remember, I give a catch-all, too, to the jury that sometimes we're in a hurry to fill out these forms, sometimes that when we get these questionnaires, we think, well, this situation may not apply to me. So I give them time before they come up, and I specifically say, perhaps your experience as a witness or a juror or a defendant in a criminal case, or if there's any prior record, things that you may have forgotten. If you didn't include it and you remember it, please tell us when you come to sidebar. And inevitably, every trial, there's somebody that says they forgot to say something, or they had a record that, you know, got in trouble when they were 17 or something. So it happens.
Right, and that's an argument against the Commonwealth's motion, because you're giving the jurors a chance to correct what they put on the initial form. There's no need for the Commonwealth to do their own independent research to confirm or deny that.
All right, so you're asking me to flat out deny the motion, but if I allow it, you'll get the copies?
Correct.
Okay. All right, why don't we take the morning break at this time, and we'll come back and we'll do that motion, the defense motion regarding Dr. Welcher.
All right, please.
You are muted.
And that is the latest from the courtroom and the hearing of Karen Reed today. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our conversations about this case, the hearings, and more. Stay with us.
This has been a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.